Whether you're a Class 5 rafter or just looking for a couple of laughs, these two have you covered. Welcome to Aaron and Zach's Better Than Mediocre Rafting Show.
Well, happy Friday, everybody. Welcome to Aaron and Zach's Entitled and Naive Rafting Show. I'm Zach. Aaron is off this week doing something, but I have a very special guest this week who's going to give us a presentation. My friend Tim Palmer. Welcome to the show, Tim.
Hey there, Zach, and everybody. Hi.
We'll just do a quick introduction. Tim, to me, is, and I'm going to embarrass you a little bit here, Tim, because I'm going to fawn over you, and hopefully things I say are correct. Tim, to me, is the ultimate paddler. Like, I respect people who paddle a lot. I don't think anybody has ever paddled as prolifically as you have. And we're not talking about, like, the waterfalls and the getting gnarly and doing the middle fork of the salmon 100 times. Like, you go boat rivers all over the country without any prejudice for anything. You've seen probably more miles in this country than anybody ever. And I love it. And while we're off goofing off doing 6-day middle fork trips and kayaking, you're generally in the middle of a month long trip down a river I didn't even know existed. And that's one of the coolest things about Tim. But beyond your paddling prowess, like all of the, you've written 30 books about rivers and conservation, and you're always giving back to, you're sharing your knowledge and doing presentations all the time about places and helping inspire us to become better stewards of where we live. And you certainly inspired me. If I haven't told you before, like you've definitely made a massive impact on my life, and I'm super appreciative. So we're super lucky to have you today, Tim. And one of my favorite facts about Tim is that he won American Rivers Life. He was awarded American Rivers first ever Lifetime Achievement Award. And that was 30 years ago. So he's done a lifetime of work since receiving a Lifetime Achievement Award from American Rivers. So super lucky to have you here today. And before I pass over the floor to you to talk about some really cool stuff, I want to share with everybody, we're doing a contest. If you're a member of the show and can name the river on the cover of this, of Tim's book, you win this book. So just put it in the comments and you win the book. So with that, Tim, with that quick introduction, I'm gonna get your presentation up and let you take over.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Zach. It is really a total blast to be with you here today. As it always is, whether we're on the Chetco River or here in the comfort of our own home and garage gear studio, it's always fun. And, you know, I was thrilled to hear that you had this show where you kind of feature rivers and issues of conservation on rivers, which, of course, is your thing and my thing both, and the interest of lots of people out there. So I'm happy to be with you and eager to talk with you today. I thought what I'd do is throw together a few slides because, you know, that's kind of what I usually do, being a photographer and a writer and a paddler. And, you know, I, as you kind of alluded to there, I am, my personal passion here is long river trips. And the three really long trips that you can do in the United States outside Alaska are the Yellowstone, the Green, and the Salmon. Those are the longest ones, really. And so I thought I'd take you on a little tour on those three streams and show you what they're like for the big picture of anyone who's really interested in paddling or maybe going there, or at least kind of getting a clue as to what it's like. And then I'll talk about a few of the conservation issues on each of these streams, which, you know, tend to be sort of indicative of conservation issues everywhere, although we certainly don't cover all of them, but it kind of give you an introduction to this sort of thing. So let's start with the Yellowstone. And here we are, you know, we all know it in Yellowstone National Park. That's about the first 100, 150 miles of the river there and above it in the Bridger-Teton Wilderness. Here we see Lower Yellowstone Falls from that brink. I think it's the most spectacular waterfall in the West, maybe in America. It's one of the biggest, one of the highest big volume falls in the West. In the park and below that, it winds through Hayden Valley, which is one of the amazing centers of wildlife in the West, where you can see bison like what we see right here, and wolves and moose and on and on and on. And then down through lower canyons, here's actually the Yellowstone Canyon, as you see, and then other canyons through this travertine formation below there. None of this is really considered boatable, and you're not actually allowed to boat there in the park. But below the park, there's some white water. It's kind of some a little bit of class three white water in Yankee Jim Canyon below the town of Gardner. And then you enter Paradise Valley. And from the Carbella access at the upper end of Paradise, which is kind of up off the bottom end of the slide here, with the river flowing away from us, you boat 30 miles or so through the spectacular Rocky Mountain Valley between the Absaroka Mountains on the east and the Gallatin Range on the west, down to the town of Livingston. But you put in there where we're still in kind of the heart of the Rockies there, right at the edge of Yellowstone. Beautiful class two big volume water. On past Livingston, it begins to widen out. Fabulous wildlife habitat. One of the most famous and sought after rainbow trout rivers in America. So there's a lot of fishing activity from drift boats and from shore anglers. Here's a flock of mergansers that are there for the same reason, fish. And on down into a transition zone between the Rockies and the Great Plains, where below Livingston you kind of enter the plains, but the mountains are really nearby, and you look at them on either side of the river or upstream, like we are here, looking back at the Absaroka Range through this mix of mountain and prairie landscape. But the mountains fade more and more, and the prairie becomes more and more dominant and more beautiful in this big river flowing through this through the Great Plains of America. One of the, to me, it's one of the three finest rivers left on the plains. Great Plains rivers have been heavily impacted and hammered, but three really great ones left are the Yellowstone, the Niobrara in Nebraska, and the Missouri in Montana. And the Yellowstone really is my favorite of these for reasons we'll see here. One being that it's not only a big river like what we saw in the last slide, but they're islands, so they're these intimate back channels where this was like day 12 of my 22-day trip for 539 miles down the Yellowstone to its mouth on the Missouri River. And here I am on this little intimate back channel at my campsite where it's running like 20 CFS. And I had to actually get out and drag a little bit to get to my tent site. There are also cottonwood trees along most of this length. There's a lot of ranch land. It's always ranch land nearby. But there's a cottonwood corridor that's reasonably intact for much of that way. There are no storage reservoirs. So there's still these native hydrologic functions with flooding and with big woody debris being washed into the river, into log jams on the shores like we see here, which are really important habitat for fish and birds and wildlife. Also, wonderful campsites on gravel bars the whole way. The mergansers kind of give way to the white pelicans, which are these spectacular, gigantic white birds with very rich black wing bars there on the bars. Here's a herd of white-tailed deer. It's a mix of mule deer and white-tailed deer as we cross through the plains, or not only transitioning from the mountains to the prairie, but also kind of from the west to the east as we go. I mentioned the cottonwood forest. Wonderful big groves of black cottonwoods. And I just had to put this photo in. Do you think this beaver had a sense of humor or what?
That is so cool.
I don't know how he did that or what he expected. I think maybe the thing is here, it's on a fisherman's path And I think this beaver was trying to figure out how he's going to get a fisherman. And, chew the log 90% through and wait for the wind to blow. Anyway, great cottonwood forest. Here's what Lewis and Clark did with the cottonwoods. They made canoes out of them. It's a very historic river for that reason. This was their part of their route to the west and back again. And just gorgeous sunsets like you get nowhere else but on the prairie. And here, way out into the plains in eastern Montana now, we've now gone like 450 miles. There's still these rocky bluffs and chalk-like cliffs that rise from the river here and there. So it's not all just flatland like you're crossing Ohio or Illinois or something. Still dramatic photography, but essentially big sky country down there with scattered cottonwoods. And then finally to the mouth of the Yellowstone where it joins the Missouri River, which is tracked across the whole sweep of northern Montana, while the Yellowstone is in southern Montana. Here we are at the confluence. I'm looking back upriver. The Missouri is on my right, the Yellowstone on my left, where the two join. And my takeout in North Dakota is just across the river on the north side or the east side of the Missouri River there. So it's a fabulous trip for people who are into lots of paddling, long trips, many miles, and great campsites. Here are a few of the kind of conservation issues affecting this landscape. One of the really big ones is riprap and reinforced banks along the upper river because it has become so popular for trophy homes in that trout fishing section. So unfortunately, there are very poor regulations regarding this. The landowner can almost do whatever they want. And you see here this this heavily impacted shoreline right there near Livingston on the upper river. Also here in the heart of Paradise Valley, there's Emigrant Peak in the background, the Absaroka Range. We're downstream from Yellowstone Park, about 30 miles or so here, upstream of the town of Lewiston. Allensburg Dam was proposed here in the 1960s and 70s, back when there was a big rush for coal development in the Great Plains nearby. The big coal companies needed a steady water supply. They were going to build a massive dam just above Livingston that would have flooded Paradise Valley. That was defeated, fortunately, by a grassroots movement in Montana. With the State Department of Fish and Wildlife being a real critical player. And it's pretty much gone away, but that's one of the big historic dam fights in the history of river conservation that occurred there on the upper Yellowstone. The river's often credited as the longest dam-free river in the country. That's not quite true. There are actually six dams, but they're all small. None of them are storage reservoirs. Of those six, only one really requires a portage of most paddlers. Two of them are on one side of islands in the river, including this one, where all you have to do is go on the north side of the island and you have no issue whatsoever. But if you go on the south side, you've got kind of a serious problem here. So I went on the north side, but beached and walked across the island to get this photo of what I missed by not taking the wrong path. Here's another one of the dams, just a short little drag over this concrete lip at low flow. There's only one of the dams that is really significant. It's called Intake. It's the last of the six, way down, like 200 miles below Billings, near a little town called Glendive. This, for years, this was just a rock rubble dam like what you see in the foreground here, but the Army Corps of Engineers is now upgrading that to a much more significant solid cement structure. And it's just kind of crazy, that we're now in the age of dam removal. We're really not building big new dams anywhere in the country. We've stopped that with the river conservation movement. But here we're now removing dams we're actually building a new one here on the Yellowstone. It's just kind of crazy. American Rivers and other groups in Montana have opposed this so far unsuccessfully. The pallid sturgeon are an imperiled fish that will not probably be able to get past the new dam. They're putting in a fish ladder passage, but they're not proven to be effective for sturgeon. So that's a big question mark. And, you know, it's just one of these cases where it kind of feels like we're still going in the wrong direction with a conservation, because a conservation campaign was unable to succeed here. There are good alternatives of tapping the irrigator's water through the smaller dam and the river itself and pumping it up, which could be done at no charge to the irrigators, but that's not the path that has been taken. There's that section of the dam that was completed when I did this trip 3 years ago. Billings is a real center of the oil and gas industry. Here, this gas refinery right on the banks of the river. There's municipal sewage and stormwater overflow issues, which you see with this foam, really stinky foam. They're generated at the city of Billings. So that's an issue there. Unit trains of coal and oil have become a new issue in the fossil fuel age here, with tracks that go along quite a length, several hundred miles of the Yellowstone shoreline. Some of them alarmingly close to the river and on banks that are shockingly erodible, like right here. And the lower Yellowstone does have a very bad history too of broken pipelines with gas and fossil fuel leaking into the river at a big scale. There's a unit train of oil, which is something we never really dreamed of years ago, but there it is along the Yellowstone. So all of those are kind of issues facing this great river of Wyoming and then mostly Montana. The longest canoe trip you can really do. So the second big trip, and am I taking too much time here, Zach? It's
you can take as much time as you want.
Pardon me?
You can take as much time as you want.
Okay. I'll keep it going though. The Green River is the only one that's kind of comparable to the salmon in terms of a essentially wild long river trip. The Yellowstone, as you saw, had lots of there were railroads, there were ranch lands, all of that. Still a great trip, but the Green and the salmon are much wilder and of almost comparable length. The salmon's a little longer, but the Green combines with a Cataract Canyon of the Colorado and the upper end of Powell Reservoir. I call it Powell Mudhole, where you have to boat 30 miles through flat water. Together, a 460-mile trip. Here's the put-in. Right at the base, you can see a Flaming Gorge Dam in Utah, right near the Colorado line. This total zoo at the put-in, you're actually not allowed to inflate your boats at the put-in. You've got to inflate them off-site and drive them in. I almost got busted by the contract law enforcement officer of the Forest Service there because I was topping off my boat on a 100-degree day. I said, you know, I got to top it off. If I blew it up on the bluff, it would have exploded on me. But anyway, here we are. This craze put in, but then you launch into gentle rapids and then pools and beautiful water through Browns Hole in Colorado. You kind of dip into the state of Colorado, then go back into Utah later. Then after 30 or 40 miles of gentle water, you enter Lodore Canyon, one of the great desert canyons of Utah. And I kind of consider it the Southwest, but it's the desert country for sure. You're actually going through a gap in the Uinta Mountains at the far eastern extent of the Uinta Range, which is a great range of towering snowy peaks that runs east-west the whole way almost to Salt Lake City. Here's Hell's Half Mile, one of the big rapids there. me rowing the raft. I've got Ann's kayak tied on. I rode the raft for this trip. Ann paddled her kayak. She had hurt her back the day before, though, and didn't really feel like doing this one. So there we are. And here we met up with an Outward Bound group, which Ann worked for at the time. And we're out checking out the river from a big view up overhead. Here's another site as we enter gentle flows between Lodora Canyon and Split Mountain, which you see here. This is a great geologic example of an antecedent river. The river was there in place when the mountains, the Uinta Range, rose up slowly. So the river was big enough, like the New River in West Virginia, that it cross-cut its way through these mountains as they came up. And so now you have these wonderful whitewater rapids there and these amazing cliffs. If you want to see what the inside of a mountain is like, you can go boat Split Mountain of the Green River up above north of the upstream of the town of Jensen, Utah. Here's what it looks like from up on the rim, looking down into that rugged canyon, and an aerial view here of this amazing winding path of the Green River as it cuts its way through the Uinta Range. I love to climb up to get these big views. You got some wonderful hiking up tributary draws on the Green River. There are many of those. But even more, I love to follow the ridge lines between two tributaries to get up to incredible views like that. You can, we're not really big enough here, but there are actually some dots in the river down there that are 18-foot rafts. Below Split Mountain Canyon in the little town of Vernal and Jensen, you enter 100 miles of flat water. And it's moving current, but it's real gentle water and absolute bug hell through much of the summer. It just doesn't seem fair that you're in a desert and have mosquitoes and black flies as bad as they are here. But they were horrendous. Ann and I actually boated with head nets on in the middle of the day a couple of these days through this section. But incredibly beautiful there with the Fremont Cottonwoods in that golden desert canyon. And what happens is the river floods in the springtime, thoroughly soaks the riparian zone of the floodplain. Then the river recedes. We come and do our trip. This is even in late summer, in late August. But there's enough water that has pooled on the floodplain there that the mosquitoes just love it. So that's kind of an issue and why a lot of people do not boat that 100 miles, even though I think it's totally worthwhile. But then we enter Desolation Canyon, which again is one of the great canyons of the West. Here, Ann and I have climbed up into this Bow Knot Bend. It's not the Bow Knot Bend. There's a bend with that name on it, but just one of many where the river loops around, and we were able to climb up to the saddle in between. Here, typical scene going down through Deso. Another group that came by while I was climbing up one of the high spots. Beautiful desert country. To me, Deso is kind of like a real easy little Grand Canyon. You know, it's really spectacular, but not quite as grand. The whitewater is good, but not nearly as difficult. You have to get a permit, but it's way easier to get it than it is in the Grand Canyon, which, of course, is almost impossible for a private boater. The shuttle, you know, is elaborate, but nothing like the Grand Canyon. So it's kind of like this easy little Grand Canyon trip that a lot of people can do who, you know, if we cannot muster the resources and the time and the money and everything it takes to run the Grand Canyon. But you can see it's kind of a lot like it here, this beautiful rapid called Cow Swim, where Ann is paddling her kayak, and here I am on a similar rapid the next day. Ann and I actually did a three-boat, two-person trip here on the Green, and every other day we'd tie on either her kayak or my canoe. That way we both got to paddle our hard boats as well as row the raft. Fabulous pictographs here, and wildlife, bighorn sheep along the canyon rims, beautiful sunsets there through the desert. on toward the town of Green River, where Desolation, which is linked kind of inseparably to Gray's Canyon, comes to its end, and you enter gentler topography than at the town of Green River. And then there's kind of this interlude below that we resupplied in Green River, the only time we got a fresh vegetable resupply at the grocery store there in Green River on the 460-mile, 40-day trip. Here we are below there, dropping into Labyrinth Canyon of the Green in Canyonlands National Park. Fabulous campsites there. And on to the confluence with the Colorado, which you see in the background of this picture. The Green is coming in from our left, the Colorado from our right. The Green is actually longer than the Colorado, where the two meet, but the Colorado carries more water. And then you drop straight into Cataract Canyon of the Colorado, which has rapids kind of at the scale of some of those of the Grand Canyon here, with big volume white water, about a dozen rapids. And there's Anne rowing the raft through one of these, checking back upstream at what we've just come through. So the conservation issues on the Green are quite different here. This is Flaming Gorge Reservoir. So if you recall, we put in at the base of the dam that forms this reservoir. And because of the cold water discharge, you have a fabulous introduced rainbow trout fishery below there. But you have inhospitable water to the native fishes, which are chubs and other fish that are native of the warm, muddy waters of the desert country there. So that's kind of one issue, and the survival of those fish, you know, becomes a very complicated matter of protecting habitat for them further downstream from that dam. All of our rivers now have big issues of exotic species invading both plants and animals. Here's what you might have considered kind of a native landscape of that canyon bottom being like, with native willows and Fremont cottonwoods. It was almost totally overrun with tamarisk or salt cedar, which was introduced to this country from Spain and Eurasia back in the 1800s to Southern California. It spread and proliferated over the river bottoms throughout the Southwest in the desert country. This was taken actually like 20 years ago, when the tamarisk was just made these impenetrable thickets on floodplains of the river. Since then, a biological predator was discovered and lab tested to assure that it wouldn't cause yet greater problems, and released. And it has killed off a lot of the tamarisk. There you can see the dead tamarisk now along one of those gravel bars. And it kind of remains to be seen how all this will wash out. The tamarisk is going to be with us to one degree or another forever. But hopefully this beetle that feeds on it and kills it will bring that habitat into better balance in the future, with a resurgence of the native willows and cottonwoods. Fingers crossed on that one. For now, we have a lot of dead tamarisk, and we're kind of awaiting a big flood to wash all that dead wood off of those bars and down into the backwaters of Lake Powell. Oil and gas development are big in the Green River Basin. Here you can see a natural oil seep on the White River, which is one of the major tributaries coming out of Colorado and Utah and entering the Green River in that 100-mile flatwater section. So oil and gas are a big issue there. This is the Green as it enters Desolation Canyon. And if you look closely there, you can see all those little pockmarked areas of lighter color dots on the map, on the photo here in the foreground and middle ground. Those are gas wells that have been drilled by the thousands and even tens of thousands across this fossil fuel basin. And of course, the BLM and the state of Utah are very supportive of these. and they leave a legacy of massive cleanup needs. They all leak methane, which is 80 times more potent as a greenhouse gas than carbon, which is what gets all the publicity, which we're trying to eliminate the carbon burning. So oil and gas drilling there, especially gas in this era, are a really big issue along the Green River. You don't really see those wells from the river, fortunately, but an aerial view here does show how close they are. So that's our long trip down the Green River. And then we come to the salmon, which, you know, it just, this is the favorite of so many of us, along with its middle fork. And the salmon, to me, is the longest trip, really desirable trip you can do in the country. You know, there's some longer trips that are dam-free in the Great Plains and Southwest, but they have a lot of diversions and land development. The Green is comparable in length, but a little less. The Yellowstone is longer, but with lots of kind of civilization along it. The salmon is relatively wild for a lot of its path. And here we are up near the headwaters in the Sawtooth Valley of Idaho. They're looking at the Sawtooth Mountains. Actually, the Finger of Fate is that rock in the middle, if any of you know the Sawtooths. I spent one of the greatest summers of my life there as a landscape architecture student working for the Forest Service in 1969, which is when I fell in love with this river and its path toward the ocean. So you can put in now, way up there, and float 420 miles to Lewiston, Idaho, on the Snake River, in the backwater of the uppermost dam, Lower Granite, on the Snake. And here we are, kind of leaving the Sawtooth Range. That's Mount Thompson in the background there above Redfish Lake, and riffling on down through this amazing Idaho landscape. There was a highway and ranch land for the first 100 miles or so here, but not really very intrusive. Here's a gorgeous rainbow after an afternoon thunderstorm near the little town of Stanley. There's our load for this 42-day trip. We actually carried almost all of our food. We carried about 10 gallons of water because it's not always easy to get good water supply, and we didn't want to be treating water constantly from the river. We had grocery stops in the little towns of Salmon and Riggins, but that was all. So we carried virtually all our non-perishable food with us, which is most of all. And then we started out with fresh food, and we had those two resupplies with vegetables and other fresh things that would last us a week or two. And got all of it on board our 14-foot Avon Adventurer there. Here's a section below the town of Salmon. Beautiful. I call this a one-sided canyon. There are these beautiful bluffs on the east side, cottonwood forests on the west side. There's Ann fixing our dinner there in that gorgeous gravel bar with our Avon tied up behind her. Then at the North Fork, you turn dramatically west and cross through this rugged mountainous heart of Idaho. This is the first big rapid, Pine Creek Rapid. You see it from the bridge on your way to Corn Creek, you're put in for the usual main salmon trip or your takeout for the Middle Fork trip. You cross the bridge, you can look downstream at this rapid. This is very likely the rapid that dissuaded Lewis and Clark from continuing down the Salmon River toward the Pacific Ocean. They got what we think was to here and named the Salmon River the River of No Return, which is a term we still use today, and went overland instead over the Bitterroot Mountains and almost starved to death there in the snow eating their horses because they didn't take the river route, but no doubt the river route would have killed them if they had gone this way. We're cutting right through seven major sub-ranges of the Rocky Mountains as we cross Idaho, right through the mountainous, wild heart of this relatively wild state. Here you can see the Salmon River's path through that landscape, from an airplane from 40,000 feet, you can see much of it has burned. And a lot of that is in recent years. I first did this long salmon trip of 420 miles in 1983. And I was hardly aware of fire scars at all at that time. Here and there, you would see them. Ann and I redid the trip here about 10 years ago, and there was always evidence of fire within view, you know, in the distant or near landscape. Here we are at Hancock Rapid, and you can see it's green in the background, but even that has been burned in that selective way that fires usually do of burning a mosaic, actually a beautiful pattern, a beautiful mosaic pattern of burned and unburned forest and trees along the river. This was what they called Salmon Falls. It's now flooded by a new rapid below there, Black Creek, which I have not yet run. Maybe you have, Zach, but there was a land. This was one of the kind of significant rapids before, but then a major debris flow out of Black Creek just shortly downstream occurred, dammed up the river, and then that dam broke. And it has created what is today probably the biggest rapid on the main salmon. But that that dam of landslide debris has essentially flooded out this rapid just above it, replacing it with a somewhat harder rapid. The salmon through this section of central Idaho runs about 80 miles of essentially wilderness and wild and scenic river and roadless terrain, which is this remarkably popular trip. You have to get a permit. It's difficult to get it. I line my long trips up so that I hit the permit checkpoint at Corn Creek the day after the permit season closes in early September, usually about September the 6th. So you still need to get a permit, but they're unlimited at that point. And then I hit Corn Creek on this trip, day 19 of our 40-day trip. And then we continued on through this section. Great places to swim in the river there, late summer. Great hiking up tributary streams and ridgelines, like this one looking down on the river below. Amazing wildlife, here, bighorn sheep along the shores. Then you come out of that river of no return section, the really popular commercial trip, and enter the lower salmon, which is much more desert-like below the town of Riggins, on for another 100 miles or so, winding through a number of distinct canyons below there. Here we are. This shot is an aerial view near Whitebird, kind of at the upper end of that lower section of river. Continuing on down in the river here, you need no permit to run this. You can go do it anytime. You need a permit, but they're not restricted. It's a good backup if you don't score a permit on a river you really want to run in the West. Wonderful campsites like the big gravel bar you see there on the left downstream. Big rapids, big fun open water, giant wave rapids through this section of the river and on down through canyons below to the very lowest canyon here. This is called Eye of the Needle Rapid. It's just a mile upstream from the mouth of the salmon where it enters the Snake. So after 400 miles on the salmon, we're entering the Snake, which is two or three times as big. Here's an aerial view of the confluence. We're looking down the Snake River here, and the salmon's coming in from the right. And so then in a much bigger flow, we go on down river to, not quite get to that yet. We ended up then going, I think it's like 20 miles or so, to Heller Bar, which is the usual takeout for Hell's Canyon trips or lower salmon trips. And I love to continue for another 30 miles of beautiful water. There's still some nice rapids, nothing big though, on to the town of Lewiston. And you kind of enter the backwater of Lower Granite Dam just about a mile above that. So you just sort of float through this very upper end of the first reservoir on the Snake River to a takeout at Hellgate Park in Lewiston for a 420-mile trip across Idaho. So the issues on the salmon are, number one, the snake, which you enter below. The snake has just mind-boggling complexity of issues, including diversions. And just to give you a glance at this, this is Twin Falls, near the town of Twin Falls, at a normal summer flow. This river that's normally 11,000 cubic feet per second is just an algae scum trickle. This is what the very same site looks like when the water's running there in a wet spring. So the issues of the snake become issues of the lower Salmon River, but the real problem on the salmon is not the usual kind of habitat issues, because the habitat is still pretty much great along this river. There's a lot of wilderness, but the four dams on the Snake River downstream of the mouth of the Salmon are what is principally responsible for what were once the greatest runs of Chinook salmon in the world being imperiled today. A number of these runs are extinct. Here you can see Chinook salmon actually on another river, but this is what their schools would look like coming up the Salmon, once the best Chinook run in the world, now heavily impacted by these dams. This is one of the minor runs. This is the run of salmon, the sockeye salmon, the spawn in Redfish Lake, one of the longest anadromous runs in the world, to the probably the highest elevation. These brilliant red and green fish are at the edge of extinction. They're kept alive only through an artificial breeding program, which is a stopgap measure at best. And we were down to two fish one year. And then they came back slightly with the breeding program, where I was able to get this photo about 10 years ago. But the survival and the restoration of these fish is really the big issue of the Salmon River and the Snake River and the Columbia downstream. Here you can see Lower Granite Dam, that first dam you come to from upstream on the Snake. There are four dams then on the Lower Snake, and then another four on the Columbia before you reach tidewater at Bonneville Dam upstream of Portland. And what we're looking at here in the foreground is the Army Corps of Engineers captive capture facility, where they actually try to capture the downstream migrating salmon smolts, put them onto barges with tens of thousands of fish, and motor them out to tidewater. It has come to that. And in spite of that, and in spite of millions and actually billions of dollars being spent trying to sustain these imperiled populations, the runs remain in jeopardy, and the wild fish populations are only getting worse. And so there's a massive campaign to try to get rid of these four Lower Snake River dams. They contribute only 3% of the Northwest power, easily replaced through conservation measures and renewables. They're not needed for irrigation. The irrigators in Washington can tap river water with just a little more draw out of pipes going down to the river, which they would get paid for. You would eliminate barging to the seaport of Lewiston, Idaho, 460 miles from the ocean. Who needs it? It loses money every year anyway. It turns out the dam here, Lower Granite Dam, is flooding the Snake River up into the town of Lewiston, which was a big supporter of these dams being built back in the 60s and 70s. And because it floods up through the town, silt is building up at the upper end of that reservoir, which, if nothing is done, will ultimately create a flood problem for the city of Lewiston, even though the Army Corps of Engineers built levees for them around the town. So the dams serve really no really legitimate purpose, or certainly no purpose that cannot be replaced easily through other means. It's killing off this magnificent run of fish. We have a viable doable, feasible solution here, which is removing these four dams. And that has been the goal of the Save Our Wild Salmon Coalition in Idaho and Oregon and other parts of the West for many years. But it's an ongoing battle. Its outcome will determine whether or not we lose these fish in one of the greatest tragedies of river conservation in America, or restore them, which would be one of the greatest triumphs. The outcome remains to be seen. So that's it for the slides, Zach. I'd be thrilled to hear any questions that you or others might have here.
Cool. Yeah. If anybody has any questions, just put them in the comments and we'll get to them. I have some, I'm interspersed my questions with questions you've already got so far, Tim.
Yeah.
But first of all, we had at the beginning, for those of you here, we had a contest to win this book for members, and we have two answers.
Ooh.
So I'm going to put the answers up. Do you see this? Do you see this first answer, Tim?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
All right. And here's the second answer.
Oh my God. They got it.
You got it. Yeah. Nice job. Got it.
Tuolumne. It's the Tuolumne.
Share where it is and a little bit about this photo.
Yeah. I'm frankly amazed that anyone, does this guy have the book perhaps? I wonder.
I mean, it's a hard one.
It's a hard one because this is not your typical view of the Tuolumne or any river. That's why I love this photo. I took this photo backpacking below Tuolumne Meadows, high flow. It was actually the day the road opened over Tioga Pass, which pretty much guarantees you peak flow. That the road usually opens about the time the river crests with snowmelt. So here we are, big, big flow, upper river at 8,000 feet in the Sierra Nevada. Crystal clear water at the brink of Glen Allen Falls, which drops off vertically, 60, 80, 100 feet, right beyond that big wave we're looking at here. So I was able to get perched out on a rock right at the edge of the falls here and to catch it at sunlight when the light was it was backlit, giving that beautiful highlight on the white water to take that photo at the brink of Glen Allen Falls. So yeah, your guy nailed it there. He's a geologist. He's been there. He's seen it. It was that guy will probably agree with me that the upper Tuolumne at high flows is one of the most amazing hydrologic phenomena I have ever seen anywhere. Because they're massive waterfalls, a whole series of them, California Falls, Waterwheel Falls, and others. And to see these at high flow is just truly spectacular and amazing. And I was lucky enough to be there then, and perhaps he was too.
So JD Rogi, send me a note with your address somehow, and I'll put this book in the mail to you. Man, that was great. We were wondering if somebody would get that. That's a hard one. All right, we're going to go through some comments.
I appreciate the guests of Yakagene. The Yakagene has great white water too. A close-up view of some rapids on the Yak might have looked like that.
Yeah.
And I actually wrote a book about the Yakagene. I go way back on that river to my youth, actually, in Pennsylvania. So the Yakagene is actually one of my favorite rivers as well. So thank you for the guests.
So here's just a comment. People loving your wood frame on the raft.
Yeah, people notice that, I guess. Yeah. It was old fashioned when I built it in 1984. I bought the raft, my Avon Adventure, almost new on the Yakagene River in 1984. Get this, I'm knocking on wood here. I've never had a leak. The old Avons are spectacular. This, of course, predated self-balers. I love the boat. I built the frame for $35 back in a day when I could never afford it. I think I can still not afford a new frame. But but I built it for $35 in my brother's garage. And, and the original frame has lasted me all these years. The big advantage in that frame too, other than all that, is that I needed something that would stack up very compact in the back of my van, which I lived in for 22 years with all my boating gear. So I needed a wooden frame to stack up in the back there, you know, not get in the way of things, which of course a big metal frame, yeah, you know, with oar locks sticking up, you know, would do. So thank you for noticing. I hope you're not laughing too hard, but maybe that's okay too.
I think they like it.
All right.
Sean's asking about water filtering. Could you not filter the water on the main salmon?
No, I did. We carried a lot of water, as I said, and I think we actually carried 15 gallons of water, which lasts Anna and I a long time. You know, we use river water a lot for boiling and all that, but just drinking, we actually carried water that almost got us through. We got water in a couple of tributaries, but we even filtered it in this day and age. Yeah.
Would you drink the water out of the main river, even if it was like, why'd you carry so much water? Even if you filtered, would you filter the water out of the main river and drink it?
I would if I drank. Yeah. When we drank from the main stream, we filtered it too.
But you brought that much water just to save filtering.
Yeah. Just to save the time and the hassle. Right. And, you know, we had the room in the boat and we didn't have any portages to do. So, you know, we didn't have to carry it anywhere. So it wasn't that big a deal to carry that much water. Yeah. It's like carrying one person, you know, it's like 50 pounds. It's like throwing a person in the boat.
Okay. I'm super curious about resupplying in the town of Green River. I remember the town of Green River as being really small.
Yeah. Yeah.
You just tie your boats up and walk up to a store and they had vegetables.
Yeah. 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 I actually stayed with the gear, but I don't think I needed to, and walked into town. She knew the town well, cause that's where she worked for nearby for Outward Bound for years. But there is a grocery store, so we were able to get vegetables and melons. If anyone, do you know Green River? It's the melon capital of the world.
I didn't know that.
And they're extremely proud of that. It's like on billboards. And so these people she met gave us a melon. Hmm. And if any of you ever carried a watermelon on a river trip, you know it's an enormous pain. And number one, no one wants to eat it, really. Oh, and you do this giant thing, and then you have all this rind to pack out. But anyway, the melon was delicious. It was just, you know, over the top.
We bring melons on our trips, and I'm starting to want to stop. I feel like melons are a very 90s thing to eat for breakfast, and nobody eats melons anymore.
No.
I don't know.
I love them, and if I go on another trip of yours, Zach, I want you to have melons.
All right. Just make sure I know, and we'll make sure. It's a big debate whether or not we bring melons on trips because they take a lot of space and they go bad. And
that's the thing. Yeah,
and we put them out, nobody ever eats them. Like maybe a few people eat them, but not as many as for how bulky they are.
Yeah, Gary's
happy to see you on the show, Tim. Did you see that comment?
Oh, okay. Oh, fantastic! Thank you.
I don't even know what any of this means. We need more broad stroke. I don't really know what this means.
More broad stroke hatchery. More salmon. Okay. Well, hatchery, I'm not going to get into this, but hatcheries are a very complicated issue. And the problems of the Columbia are their own because the dams are impacted the fish so much. But other than efforts to simply keep a species from going extinct, hatcheries can present a lot of problems. And because they introduce diseases, they mask the decline of wild fish. The hatchery fish end up competing with the wild native fish. They spawn on top of them and compromise the gene pool of the wild fish. And ultimately, to keep hatcheries running, we need wild fish too to supplement the hatchery stock with better quality genetics all the time. So hatcheries can do a lot of damage. All that said, where you have fish going extinct because of dams, hatcheries like in the case of the sockeye in Redfish Lake, that's the only way to keep them alive while theoretically, while we solve the bigger problems, which of course we've got to do in the long term if these fish are going to survive. So enough said on that, I think.
Here's another question about jet boats. I mean, do you feel like jet boats on the salmon and snake pose river health problems? And if so, are these big issues?
Yeah. So, again, complicated. It's complicated. These rivers, the snake in particular, is so big that river health problems, probably not. On smaller rivers, I often suspect that the wakes of jet boats are damaging because anybody can do it. You stand there on the shore and the water going by is crystal clear, and a jet boat comes by in its wake, which throws ashore about 20 or 30 waves in its cycle, agitates the shoreline and makes it very turbid so that you can then see in the water only a foot or two for some minutes until the water flows on past and you have clear water again. So they cause a lot of siltation of streams and shoreline erosion, which can have a lot of effects. So that is a problem typically with that use. The snake is so big that it's really not a problem there. And the controversies over jet boats on these rivers have dealt more with the recreational experience. And of course, the jet boats are big, they're noisy, they create wakes. You know, they're kind of a pain for everybody who's not on the jet boat. Yeah. And so, you know, that's been kind of the source of conflict. And then they were, for years, decades actually, river runners doing the trips like we do, rowing or paddling, were heavily regulated by the Forest Service and very limited in Hell's Canyon, while jet boats weren't at all. And that was remedied slightly with improved management here in the last 10 or 20 years. But it's been a very, you know, it's been a difficult path coming to terms with these two different kinds of recreational use. You know, one that is all manual and really favors solitude and quiet and that kind of thing, and the other, you know, which doesn't. So, you know, it's been a difficult controversy.
Tim, this reminds me, Aaron and I on the show have been talking a little bit about wilderness and wild and scenic rivers and what we can and can't do and why things are allowed. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you're my guru. When I get caught in a, like, I'm like, I'm not sure I call you and say, Tim, help me understand this issue better. And I think one thing we talked about, I'm guessing Heidi is wondering the same thing, is why are jet boats allowed in wilderness and when a wheelbarrow isn't?
Because they were there before the wilderness was designated. That's the simple answer. They were a pre-existing use that nobody at the time had the political stomach to try to ban. And so they were grandfathered in into the lower salmon, you know, the snake in Hell's Canyon, a few other rivers, the Deschutes, a few other rivers. Beyond that, you know, some of the agency people would say they're useful for management of the river, you know, because they kind of use them that way a little bit and for patrol and for safety. You know, so some people make that argument. But I think really the nugget there is they were already there. And, you know, the politicians designating the river had to deal with conflicting advocates at the time and opponents at the time, and the jet boat lobby was strong, and so they were able to grandfather them in.
I mean, in the case of the Maine salmon, which I think we're kind of talking about a little bit here, would it be fair to say that the Frank Church Wilderness would never have passed if they had tried to preclude jet boats?
Yeah, probably not.
Yeah, probably. So it's like we wouldn't even have the wilderness if we try to fight the jet boaters. So it's right. Sort of a compromise we've come to get a large wilderness area.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And of course, not the only one, you know, that happens quite a bit actually. And, you know, and it was a reasonable decision at the time. You know, at the time, Wild and Scenic Rivers were a new thing. Not that the result would be any different today. But, and I guess, you know, taking an optimistic view, you can say, well, it's a triumph of compromise, too, because, you know, they were able to remain and yet were able to stop dams and other worse things. And hopefully Hell's Canyon is kind of not a good example of this, but the salmon is a better one. That, you know, where the jet boat traffic hopefully won't get a whole lot heavier and worse. So, you know, kind of a triumph of compromise. And, you know, that's something we have to do to get along in this world.
And, you know, we had another debate a few weeks ago, Aaron and I, with every, we were having this discussion about in wilderness, is a hand drill, do you feel like a hand drill is in the spirit of the Wilderness Act? Like, are we allowed to use like a battery powered hand drill in the wilderness? Like, where is that line?
Yeah. You mean a hand drill, like repairing your boating gear or something?
Yeah. Or just like, you know what I mean? Like a cordless drill.
Yeah.
Is that precluded by the Wilderness Act? Or is it gray area?
Gosh, I've never heard. It would probably be gray area if it actually ever came up. But because
it has come up. I know some wildernesses it's not allowed, but I do know other areas it is allowed. And it's in I just want to get your thoughts. What do you think? Like about should hand drills be allowed?
I never heard of this one before, Zach, but you know, practically speaking, it's not really going to hurt anything because no one else is going to hear it. And, you know, I assume you're fixing a frame or something, you know, with a drill, making a repair. You know, it's hard to really think there's anything wrong with that. It's not like it's a chainsaw, you know, which makes a lot of noise and can do a lot of damage in the wrong hands. Yeah. It's not like you're going to do any other damage with a hand drill.
Okay, I got another one for you.
If it's just with wood, I would say you do use a manual drill, you know, that's not electric powered, and then there'd be no question.
But okay, so let's say we're saying, okay, a hand drill is cool because it's not no harm, no foul. It doesn't really, it's not specifically precluding the Wilderness Act because it's not mechanized transport. But what about an electric chainsaw?
I think they would be not allowed under most rules today. Am I right?
I don't know. I mean, this is almost an ethical thing. Like ethically, I can see a gas chainsaw might ethically bad, but where is the line? You know, how much battery power should we bring?
Well, I think, you know, I'm not an expert on this because, you know, this is not my field, but it's mechanical. I mean, my impression is that mechanical things are not allowed. That's why mountain bikes are a problem, even though they're not motorized.
You know, it says the wilderness act is mechanized transport. No. So I can see why mountain bikes aren't allowed because they're mechanized transport, a mechanized tree cutter isn't specifically allowed.
Yeah, yeah. I think it would be disallowed though, you know, and you can certainly do more damage with a cutting down trees than you can riding a mountain bike.
We had a lot of debates about this the show a few weeks ago, so I love getting your inputs on it.
I think we're going around the edges of the issue, though, you know, the edges of the bigger issue, which is wilderness is great because, you know, the mechanized stuff, the technological world is outside, and we have a place to go to escape that. And, you know, I'm all in with that idea.
Yeah. And I think we ended with like this, we want to do things in the spirit of wilderness.
Exactly.
In the spirit of wilderness, a place we can go and get away from this stuff and have solitude and have the experiences. And that's the spirit of what we're trying to do when we decide whether or not we have a battery-powered toothbrush or a battery-powered hand drill or in the spirit of the Wilderness Act.
You know, Zach, there's a, if I'm not interrupting here with your question, there is an issue regarding wild and scenic rivers that's sort of similar in the sense of, you know, is it practical or do you go the practical way or the purest way? And that is the question of what constitutes a free flowing river. And this has been debated heavily also, not recently because it's been resolved pretty conclusively, but back in the day, myself and many people, questioned this issue of what constitutes free flowing. And I was actually an expert consultant on this issue on One River to determine whether it's free flowing or not. And so what is really intended by that, by the founders of the act and those who wrote it, was to that the river be free flowing in that it's not blocked by dams. So free flowing current, no dams stopping the current. That's what free flowing means. You also then have the question of historic precedent of what is designated as a wild and scenic river. And there are a few rivers that actually have small dams within the designated reach, but they're all kind of recognized as such and grandfathered in, and there are only a few of them. More importantly, the interpretation of the act has consistently recognized that dams outside the specific reach being designated do not make it an impounded river. The reach alone is what is critical as free flowing. So you can have dams above or dams below. And we do on, a whole long list of the designated wild and scenic rivers have dams above or below or both. At a more purist level, you can say, well, forget about the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act and what is actually legally applies to that. And just from a more purist standpoint, think about what constitutes a free-flowing river. Is a river that's heavily diverted free-flowing? And I would call that more a debate of whether the river is pristine or not. And because there are rivers with massive diversions, but not dams within the wild and scenic reach. And the question is, do those diversions make them ineligible for wild and scenic status? And typically they do not, unless they really destroy the values for which the river was designated, such as fish and wildlife. Am I making sense here, Zach?
Yeah, actually, this is interesting because we had a disagreement about something like this on our show recently. Yep. One of our quiz questions, or I gave away one of your books a few weeks ago, and the question is, what two things have to occur for a river to be eligible to be wild and scenic? Mm-hmm. And so the answer I gave, which I think is correct, is they have to have at least one outstandingly remarkable value and be free flowing.
Yes.
So those are the two things you have to be considered eligible to be wild and scenic. Mm-hmm. And then what you're saying is free flowing means the section considered wild and scenic, because the whole river isn't designated. Typically it's just a section,
right?
That particular section has to be free flowing, which means no dam on that section, but there could be a dam upstream that controls the flow.
Yeah. Totally.
So like free flowing is a little bit weird, because if you say it's not technically free flowing because something's impounding it upstream and stopping the flow and changing the flow, free flowing in terms of the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act means that particular segment has nothing that impounds the flow in there, except like you said, like there can be small little diversions. You know, there's sometimes little really small dams that don't really like store water. They just like impede it.
Yeah.
That's a good side topic. And yeah, we had a little debate about that as well. All right. We got more questions, I think, Tim. I'm going to go down.
Okay.
Some of the stuff I want to bring up, some of it I don't. Some things get political fast like this. We'll just keep going. I don't think every single hatchery should be producing brood stocks of a backup plan. Shut them down is a mistake. I don't know if we want to get into that one. Maybe we'll move on. This could get complicated quick. But another question, I think we were talking about wilderness and wild and scenic rivers. What about drones?
My take is that they would not be and should not be allowed in wilderness. You know, they're mechanical and, you know,
What about wild and scenic rivers?
Well, for a wild designation, I think that would depend on the management plan. And I don't think we have a whole lot of precedent on that yet, Zach, because you know, the agencies are really behind in updating the plans for these rovers, and drones have really become popular since most of the plans have been done or even considered for updating. So that's the, you know, that's kind of a timely question. And, you know, I would think that they would be banned from at least wild sections of rivers.
Or, when you say wild, just so people understand, because it's, you're getting like, when a river is designated wild and scenic, it's actually sub-designated wild or scenic or recreational. So if it's a wild and scenic river that's specifically designated wild, you would say probably not. But if it was scenic or recreational, probably okay.
Well, I don't know.
Yeah, but like, ethically, still, that sounds
still, like jet boats, there's still a pain for anybody not. You know, the I was on a trip where a friend of mine, a filmmaker, was using one, and he got special permission to use it from the agency on a kind of a one-off arrangement. You know, they weren't approved for use. He got a you know, a dispensation from what apparently was a rule that they could not be used. So, but good question, you know, for management plans that are now being done.
I know a lot about this topic as I fly drones. So I'm just going to add a little bit to it. I think in wilderness, they're not allowed and they shouldn't be allowed.
Mm-hmm.
But the key is they're not allowed to take off or land. You can technically fly them into wilderness. From what I understand, you just can't take off or land within wilderness.
No.
In wild and scenic rivers, it depends on the agency's rulemaking. They can have specific rulemaking. So a really interesting fact is the Rogue, a really interesting case.
Mm-hmm.
Because the BLM section of the Wild and Scenic River, they're not allowed because the agency has made a rule, which is a good rule. I love the rule. On the Forest Service part, an interesting fact, you may or may not know this, Tim. You probably know this. The wilderness boundary for the Wild Rogue Wilderness ends at the Wild and Scenic River boundary. They don't overlap.
Mm-hmm.
Usually they overlap.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the Forest Service has made a rule against drones in the lower part of the Rogue.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you could technically take off, even though you're like surrounded by wilderness, because the Wild and Scenic River Corridor is not technically wilderness, you could take off from the river corridor and land in the river corridor because the Forest Service hasn't made a rule as far as I know.
Mm. Sounds like a loophole that should be covered.
Yes, it should be covered. I don't want drones allowed on the Rogue personally.
Right.
So I'd love to see just it all taken care of. But isn't it interesting they made the wilderness boundary at the Wild and Scenic boundary? Usually they overlap. Like there's wilderness and Wild and Scenic overlapping, but they ended it. And I think that was the jet boaters saying, we want to make 100% sure that we have no issue jet boating that lower section.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, sorry. I've read a lot about this particular issue.
Okay.
What about wheelchairs in wilderness?
I don't know about that. Not my field.
Yep. And Paul says you have to use crosscut saws. Yeah. Yep. I think that's the beauty of wilderness, is that you have to hike in with a saw and do the work yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Aaron has an answer to that one. Well, that's the end of the questions we have so far, but I have a couple more here I wrote down as we went, and then we'll finish this up, Tim. Does that sound good? Mm. Okay, I have another big question. You might say this is outside my field, but you got me thinking. What do you think about removing the Glen Canyon Dam? Is that a realistic thing?
Well, probably not now. I mean, there's a very good case for doing that. In that the power could be replaced. The dam is very destructive of the river below because it traps silt, and so the Grand Canyon beaches have eroded massively. But you know, it's a big dam, and it's not that old, and it's serving important purposes, you know, unlike even our Snake River dams, and certainly unlike any of the dam removals that we've had so far. you know, which have largely been these old bucket of bolts dams that really don't serve much modern purpose and are often nothing but safety hazards. It's not like that. It's way harder than that. The big wild card with Glen Canyon is the climate and the desiccation of the Southwest. And as it is, the reservoirs, Glen Canyon and the reservoir Lake Mead behind Hoover Dam, they're, you know, they're evaporating and they're essentially drying up, you know, and they may hit levels below which they can't even produce hydropower in the near future. So the usability of that dam may continue to decline over the years to the point that it's really not serving much of a purpose. And at that point, you know, if we regard that trend as long-term, then the campaign to get rid of it would have even more strength than it does now. But, you know, the people wanting to remove Glen Canyon have built a strong case for doing that as it is. And the other ultimate argument for it is that the reservoir is filling up with silt rapidly. And the projection I have heard is that in 100 years, and this was some years ago, that it would be essentially be full of silt. So the dams are not renewable, continuing, you know, maintenance-free sort of facilities. You know, they have a timeline at which point they will be useless. And we as a society have not considered that at all. You know, virtually none of the dams that have been built included a program for dismantling them, for recognizing the long-term ultimate impacts of them, that have a retirement plan for dismantling them and getting rid of the silt, even though that is inevitable with every one of them. It's only a matter of time. And Glen Canyon is one of those that is kind of very high profile in that regard, because it's such a big dam, it's such an amazing canyon, it's filling with silt so fast that all of it brings that issue to, you know, to light in a much more kind of urgent sort of way.
You said the word desiccation, or does it desertification?
Yeah, desiccated rivers, basins becoming desiccated, dried up. The climate's getting drier and drier. The river flows are getting lower and lower. The reservoir levels are getting lower and lower too. Evaporative loss, 6 feet evaporates off the top of those big reservoirs in the Southwest, even if, you know, the levels are maintained. So, you know, all these become much bigger issues in the age of the climate crisis, and they're only going to get worse.
That's what I was going to ask. So you're saying that, like, the climate change is making its watershed more of a, like, they're not getting as much water as they used to, snow and rain.
Way
so the flow just isn't coming out of that region, and it hasn't for a while. And that probably isn't getting better. That's
sure. It's way worse than it was. Okay. I mean, even before the dramatic shift in what we consider the climate crisis today, the flows of the Colorado were grossly overestimated when those dams were planned and built.
Okay.
And so they allocated use to the basin, upper and lower basin states, on the basis of flows in what happened to be an extremely wet era of analysis.
Yeah.
In the 20s and the teens and 20s and so forth. So even before climate crisis, we had a problem. And since then, the last 20 years, it's been just apocalyptic drought.
Yeah.
You know, the worst drought in 1600 years now, and it's still getting worse. So all of these things are going to change even in our lifetimes here. And, you know, there'll be some big adjustments that need to be made. Think big in terms of Phoenix, Arizona. You know, can Phoenix, Arizona exist in the long term? It's a fair question to ask.
Yeah. Let's move on. I have one more question for you. It's kind of a multi. This could be a lot of questions, but, like, I'm very fascinated with this Yellowstone trip, and I wrote down a bunch of questions I'm not going to answer because we'll just talk for another hour, and I'm sure people want, you have things to get to, but on the Yellowstone. I'm assuming that was all canoes, right? You guys were in canoes the whole time?
I did a solo trip by canoe, yeah.
Okay. And so it's like class one, maybe a couple of class twos. It's not super hard.
No, lots of two.
Lots of two.
Lots of two, yeah.
Do you need any sort of permit? Or you can just like launch and just you just go. There's no permits.
No. And nobody does it.
Okay.
Nobody.
Are there shorter? Like, but I'm assuming you can break it up into shorter pieces.
Oh, there's access, you know, like usually within 10 miles.
So if I want to go and make like a 40-mile trip, I could find one there.
You could find a 40-mile piece almost anywhere on the river.
Okay. Because I don't see myself, like, I so admire that you have, like, the gumption to, like, I'm going to go do a 40-day trip. I don't know if I have that gumption, but I would love to go see it. I've never seen that part of the world. So, like, the idea that I could go out, you know, with my gumption and do, like, a 5-day trip and just see that part of the world, it's something I could just get in my car, drive to put in, load it, and get done. And
hitchhike the shuttle or call a friend nearby and help you out or whatever.
Can I get an Uber?
You probably could.
And were there grocery stores on the way?
Well, no. I mean, you could, but it's harder than it looks. When you look on the map, there are these little towns along the way, but they're typically a mile or two back from the river. Okay. So it's a long hike, and I thought I would use those for water, but that's a long way to carry a water jug. And I ended up
see with the water jug on your shoulder for like a mile to get water.
60 pounds of water, yeah. I rewatered twice at parks that had spigots right near the river. And here's what you need, Zach. My book, Rivers, Field Guide to Rivers of the Rocky Mountains. Whole section on the Yellowstone, you know, tells you about that. But like grocery stores, no, it wouldn't be worth schlepping into town to do that. You know, just carry it with you.
Okay. But you were filtering some water, I'm assuming, too.
No, I used all my own water.
Is it because the water's gross?
Or you don't like filtering? I just don't like the filter. I don't like the time. You know, I just have a little filter, like a backpack filter. And I don't like to take the time and, you know, worry about the filter, cleaning the filter constantly, which you have to do because the water is not absolutely pristine there. You know, so you have to clean the filter constantly. And it's just a pain where I'd rather be. Actually, I was really busy on that 539-mile Yellowstone trip because I planned to do it in 20 days, which is about 30-mile days, which for me is no big deal, you know, on a moving river, paddling solo, so long as, you know, I don't have horrific headwinds and all that. But it turned out I put in kind of late August, so most of the trip was in September, and it had been a super hot, super summer dry, you know, summer that turned to a very blustery autumn on day three of my trip. So from basically day three on, I had really foul weather. And I actually lost 4 days when I could not travel because of driving rainstorms. It was snowing in Bozeman. Wow. You know, driving rainstorms where I was, just couldn't be on the water as a solo paddler, and you get soaked if you were and whatnot. So then suddenly I was looking at 40-mile days in a canoe alone. And I really, you know, I got up before dawn, and I just kind of paddled like hell all day long to make it to the takeout in time for where my ride was picking me up, which was kind of a set schedule.
Yeah, it's not like now where you carry a cell phone or a sat texter and you're like, hey, I'll be there in 2 days. You're probably, when you started the trip, said, I will be here on this date.
Right.
You had to be there.
Yeah, I actually had a buddy coming from Wisconsin to Bozeman, and he was going to give me a lift on his way. So he didn't have the flexibility, you know, which is why.
Yeah.
If I were just scheduling a shuttle pickup, it would have been different.
Yeah. So the days you couldn't boat, you just slept, were just in your tent waiting for the rain to stop.
Yeah. And it tended to be half days.
Okay.
And, you know, this is kind of weird for me because I didn't even own a cell phone until, you know, a few years ago, but you're within cell phone range almost the whole time on the Yellowstone because there's an interstate highway not too far away.
Yeah.
And so I had a phone, and the weather was crazy. and Anne was at home. So there were days when if things were looking iffy to me, I call up Anne and have her check the weather report and say, oh my God, at noon tomorrow, a storm is going to hit and there's going to be 25 mile an hour winds. So I knew to paddle before noon and make camp. And, you know, I literally did get the tent up by noon and then all hell broke loose.
I mean, now you can have your iPhone out and see the weather track coming in. Now the technology is unbelievable.
Yeah, I don't have any of that, but Anne covered for me, you know, by looking it up on the computer at home.
Yep.
But yeah, you could absolutely do that on the Yellowstone. But come on, Zach, you would love a long trip there. I mean, I understand you don't have time because of running your business, but, you know, you would love a 20-day trip on the Yellowstone, and maybe we should do it together sometime.
I'd love that. I think the one I want to do the most, I mean, it's hard. I love to do the salmon trip. Although the part through Chalice to me seems a little rough.
No, it's beautiful.
Okay.
Every foot of the salmon trip is exquisite. And, you know, some of it's ranch land. There's a road alongside and all that. But the upper 150 miles of that trip are the best long distance class two canoeing in America. And, you know, it's all there's a little class three at the top end, a little four if you do enough of it, but mostly class two for 150 miles. And it's beautiful and they're nice campsites, even though it's not what. And I saw actually no other boaters for like 12 days. Then, of course, as soon as you hit Corn Creek, you see boaters all the time on the wild section. But above that, you know, I never saw anybody. So
if I'm going to do a long trip, it's probably going to be the salmon. But I also, the Green has a special place in my heart. One of my first river trips ever was canoeing from Green River to the Confluence.
Yeah. Labyrinth water.
Yep. That was one of my first river trips ever. Me and a friend in college just rented a canoe and just did it.
Yeah.
And I'd love to go back. Like, I'd love to piece together the Green. So if I did long trip, it would be one of those two. I think I'd like to just do like a 5-day on the Yellowstone. I don't know if I have the ability to do all those long trips, but it's certainly on my list.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we're going to shut this down. For everybody watching, I would highly urge you to check out one of Tim's books. If you go to Amazon and search Tim's name, there's beautiful coffee books like this. He has a bunch of field guides. That one's a gem.
Yeah.
And that one I love because it has, like, it's America's 50 greatest river journeys, right? So it has an amazing selection of rivers across the country.
Yeah. And these two are field guides to California rivers and Oregon rivers.
You know, I leave that Oregon river as one of my truck. It's always in my truck.
Thank you.
I use it sometimes. And those are great because it's not just the field guides are great. They're not just boating.
Right.
It's hiking. So if I'm in the middle of Bend and I have a day I want to do something, I might go look for a river nearby I want to hike next to. So it has, those are great books. The field guides are great.
Thank you, Zach.
So please, if you guys are watching, search Amazon, Tim Palmer. You'll find all kinds of cool stuff.
I got a website, timpalmer.org.
Yep. I'll put a link to that when I'm done, I'll put a link at the bottom of the YouTube video so people can see it. And Tim, thanks for joining us.
It's been fun, Zach. Love being with you.
And there's a comment from somebody too, even.
Oh, Sean. Thank you, Sean.
See the comments. It's kind of fun to have the comments, huh?
It totally is. Yeah. So long. It was here like that.
Yeah. That's it for this week. We'll try to. There's another comment. We'll get you on again here in the future, if you're willing.
Yeah. Let's do it again.
And Tim, I'm going to do an ending here, but stay on because we can still chat afterwards.
Okay.
So I'm going to do this. I'm going to say goodbye to everybody and we'll see everybody next week. Tim, I'll see you in a few minutes.
Okay.